I'm really excited about today's guest. I've always been a fan. I've been a fan of him as a performer, producer, entertainer, a fan of him as a politician and as a human being. He's, of course, the great Al Franken, the former senator from the great state of Minnesota. We've got a lot of politics to talk about. He's also got a major podcast, the Al Franken Podcast. He's got a super PAC, the Midwest Values PAC, that we'll talk about. He's recently started a huge stand-up tour. Al Franken launched the aptly named An Evening of New Stand-Up with Al Franken. It kicked off in Chicago a few weeks ago. We got a lot to talk about. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yeah. First, what I want to talk about first is a little bit. Obviously, you were one of the original SNL players, one of the primetime players.
I wasn't a player.
You weren't officially called a player if you were just even a writer, producer. That was not officially called a player.
I was officially a writer.
You were one of the creators. You were one of the
I wouldn't say that either. Lauren's
what the
creator.
Fuck are we going to say? What would we just say? Lauren would get upset. We don't want to upset Lauren.
It's not upset. It's the truth. He created the show.
Right. You were one of the original
writers.
Okay, yeah, writer. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, but and then I became a producer at one point.
And I also became a featured player. Featured player.
Well, you know when they do the stuff, yes. You know, with...
And featuring.
I was a featured.
Featured, doing such amazing things like Stuart Smalley, among others. And the reason I'm bringing up SNL is they're doing a movie. They just casted a movie about the original season, the 1975 season, which you're part of. What do you know about the movie?
Next to nothing. People came to me starting in, 1981 or something like to do a movie about SNL. And I never really seriously even addressed the subject in terms of what would I do for a Saturday night movie. I think what they're doing is the lead up to the first show.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. So they'll show rehearsals and they'll show, but I don't know if they show the first show.
Which is really, in reading Shale's book, there was not this single vision going into it as you would think now. It really came together in this weird way with Ebersol and Lauren looking for talent on, in the comedy clubs. And
Tom and I were the only writers that he hired that he didn't meet.
Yeah.
And I think how my life might have been different if he had met us. And you never know how that would have gone.
Right.
But what we did was we submitted a package of material. We were doing stand-up, Franken and Davis, in L.A. at the Comedy Store. And a William Morris agent saw us and said, why don't you come to my office and we'll talk. And he said, do you want to write for TV? And I said, sure. We said, but there's nothing on that we can write for. Carson was great. I think Carson was just
The Smothers Brothers was probably the most political show out
there. And it was canceled.
It was canceled, yeah.
It was canceled because of when anti-Vietnam War. That's why they were canceled. So they weren't on. So all that was on, I know this very well.
Phyllis Diller.
Well, she was a comedian. I don't think she had...
Flip Wilson? I'm trying to think. Was Flip Wilson
Flip on? Wilson had a show, but not. Okay. He was not on at that time.
Okay,
so anyway, so all that was on at the time was Carson, Carol Burnett, which is a great show.
Of course.
But we clearly, generationally, were not going to write for them. And Sonny and Cher.
Yeah.
Was doing a show and it was pretty bad. It was pretty lame.
Yeah.
And that was it. So we said, there's nothing, we would love to be TV writers. We'd love to get a job. In fact, you can see right behind me over my right thumb, that's Tom.
Right.
And there's a picture, of me. Someone painted a thing of me and Tom when I was on tour and they gave it to me. And so it really means a lot to me. So Tom and I, he said, why don't you write something for a show you'd like to see? So we wrote a package that included a newscast, a commercial parody, a sketch, which was a parody of Sonny and Cher, and a conceptual film.
So you didn't know at the time that there were going to be films in it and commercial parodies and news parodies.
No.
This is just arbitrarily what you guys came up with.
Yeah, that's what we came up with. And to be fair, our newscast was not the kind of format of Weekend Update. Our newscast was a newscast on the night of the day of World War III. So it's just a local news show going, tragedy, death, catastrophe. Highlight tonight's news after this message. And then, and well, today it happened, World War III. I remember this bit that we did. So that's what we submitted. So, and we got hired. I think we were the last writers hired too.
Do you remember? We'll just spend another minute or two on this. I got so much politics I want to talk about with you. Do you remember the moment where you went like, okay, this is a game changer? Was it could have been a moment while it was on the air or the first New York Times article or when you just said, we're not in Kansas anymore?
It was before the first show. And Tom was very cynical all the time. And I said, I remember just turning to him and saying, hey, Tom, this is going to be a big hit. Which is the stupidest thing to say about anything, anytime. Right. Because they never are.
Right.
And Tom went, yeah, yeah. And I said, no. And it was, look who we have. We have Aykroyd. We have, you know, Michael O'Donohue's writing. We have, you know, Herb's Heart, and we have all these, you know, and just we have Gilda, and it was the first time that our generation was able to be on TV.
Yeah, yeah. I remember being, I was a college freshman, and we literally, you would have it on at the parties. So it would be not like people were staying home, but it became part of what you were doing. So you'd be at a party, right. There'd be 40 or 50 people there, and 20 of the 30 or 40 or 50 people would be watching it, and then the party would be going on. It was just it immediately just became part of the culture.
Well, and just remember what TV was like then. We had NBC.
Yeah, that's it. I
mean, ABC, had CBS, and Fox.
The three
I
local
think Fox
stations.
Was on.
No, there was no there was no Fox then.
No
you
Fox?
Had the local. You had, okay. You had the local, what was the equivalent of Channel 5 in New York, for instance, and Channel 7 and Channel 11. There were three independent stations, but there was no Fox network at that point.
Yeah, so we get, I mean, if you look at the numbers we got then compared to what anything gets now, I mean, we'd get these 50 share.
Yeah.
And we get, well, our highest rated show ever was Cicely Tyson was the host.
Jesus, go figure, right?
It was a huge blizzard.
Okay.
That carpeted the.
But we're going to give Cicely. We're going to give Cicely Tyson the credit, though. Okay. We're going to just say it was a huge, huge tune in. What was your favorite show of all time? The single best show that you think you guys ever put on?
Oh, that's really hard. Steve Martin's shows were always
great.
Great.
I was in the audience for a Steve Martin Jackson Brown show. Talk about a great show.
Wow.
I was in the audience.
See, that's pretty good, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty good stuff.
Yeah.
And the way I got tickets was I was dating a girl whose uncle was Herb Schlosser, who was at the time the
president. Oh, there you go.
Supposed to be a very decent guy, president. I know he's
You know what's a funny thing? I loved the Grateful Dead. I love the Grateful Dead.
Okay.
And we finally got them on. We finally convinced Lorne. I don't want to make it too long a story. So Dead come on, and they did their first show, and the laughter wasn't as for the show. We do a comedy show, but anybody who had an uncle who was in the sales department at NBC and was a Long Island Deadhead got tickets. So they're a conniving bunch, the Deadheads.
Yes. Oh, they'll do
and
anything.
So maybe like a third of our audience was Deadheads, and they weren't. They were just there for the Dead.
They were just. They were. Yeah. That's very funny. I didn't remember that the Dead were.
So Lorne. Then he had him a second time a few years later, and the same thing happened, and he just said, "I'm not gonna have him the Dead again."
Okay. last question. Then we move on from SNL. Single most surreal moment for you. I think I remember it was you in that. In Shale's book, you talk about going down and watching Paul McCartney sing Hey Jude.
Yes.
And just in rehearsal and going, holy shit, I'm actually here listening to this.
Okay, so Paul McCartney's the music guest. Music guest is the first thing rehearsed.
Yeah.
Because they're in the music set. So there's no set to build. So we do that. And everybody at 30 Rock knows who the music is that week. And it's Paul McCartney. So everyone in the building who could wheedle their way in is in the bleachers, is on the floor for Paul McCartney. And he says, Ron says to him, could you do Hey Jude? And Paul goes, well, we're not doing it this tour. I can't do Paul. And okay, turns to the guys, his musicians, who are like the best musicians in the world, and they know Hey Jude. So right. He goes, okay. So then they play Hey Jude, and I start to like tear up because it's Hey Jude.
Yeah.
And that when I was, it came out when I was like 16 or 17, and I remember I'd always arrive someplace, and if I've already arrived, I'd wait till the end of that song, you know? And I just was so moved by it. Then the next time we have the rehearsal is at dinner time, and on the day of the show, and we did Gap Girls that week. Mm-hmm. Remember the Gap Girls sketch?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Well, they had a lot of Gap clothes in that sketch, so they had so a
everybody
guard
was there. They had guards there. I remember they had a guard there.
Yeah. So I'm looking there, and they play Hey Jude, and the guard is just transfixed, and I needed a pair of 36-30s. And so I just watched him, and I watched him again during Dress, and I watched him again during Air. And during Air, I went up, I took two pairs of 36-30s.
Confession, Al Franken, there you have it.
I told the prop guy.
Ready to age awesome? Pop in your AirPods and join me, Katie Fogarty, over on A Certain Age Podcast, an age-positive podcast that helps you live your best evolving midlife loud and proud. We know the only constant is change. Kids grow, jobs come and go. What it takes to be fit, healthy, happy, fulfilled in midlife looks way different than it did in our 20s and 30s. A Certain Age features expert voices and real women, 40, 50, 60, and beyond, with tips, tools, and resources to help with the hard stuff, menopause, aging parents, career change, and light you up about what's next. Each week, we talk wellness, beauty, family, money, purpose, fashion, and fun in frank, funny interviews that go straight to the heart of issues facing women. One Apple Podcast review says, each episode is a gold mine of ideas, emotional support, and self-discovery. I feel like I'm part of the conversation at the best dinner party imaginable. A Certain Age Podcast. Live midlife out loud.
Hi, I'm Kate. And I'm Corinne. We host the podcast Pop Fiction Women, and our tagline is, we're complicated. What does that mean exactly? To us, it just means real, three-dimensional human beings with contradictions and conflict who also happen to be women. On this podcast, we engage in the simple but subversive act of taking women seriously. Whether it's a discussion of a classic rom-com or current hit movies written and directed by women, like Barbie or Saltburn, you can be sure we'll bring our own dynamic spin. And we recap some of the buzziest TV shows like Succession, White Lotus, and Yellow Jackets. We also discuss book-to-TV adaptations like Daisy Jones, Tell Me Lies, Expats, Fleischman, and The Last Thing He Told Me. We give you a seat at the table with your favorite New York Times bestselling authors in our Complicated Conversation series, and we introduce you to the next rising star in our debut discussions. In both interview formats, we always ask the most important question of all, what's your sign? Subscribe or follow Pop Fiction Women wherever you get podcasts.
So let's get into less happy times right now. Here's what I don't get. And I never think I'm the smartest guy in the room, but I've been saying so much on air. People just talk about very matter-of-fact, well, our democracy is on the line. People are not getting what that truly means. I keep trying to paint pictures on the air. Well, do you understand, for instance, if you're a CEO and he gets elected and he doesn't like your face, you're gone. Do you understand that if you're MSNBC and that MSNBC could no longer exist because he'll threaten Comcast that he'll take the company apart? Do you understand your grandchildren may never vote again? Do you understand he'll put the Insurrection Act in and all of a sudden at his whim decide to sic the military on individuals? People are not filling in the dots of what truly how dark this can get. Why is this not registering with people?
I think no one lays it out because I think people want to this is why it's useful. I had Ann Applebaum on my podcast last week, and I kind of asked her how does it happen, you know? And she said it doesn't look like the Third Reich. It doesn't look like that kind of stuff. But she gave an example of was chilling. She said to be a member of the RNC, to get a job at the RNC now,
you have to say have to say you're an election denier. That's the first thing they ask you.
Who won the 2020 election? And you have to say Donald Trump. Yeah. So you have to be willing to lie.
Yeah.
In order to get a job there. That's your first qualification.
Yeah.
And so she started with that. But, you know, he has plans to get rid of the deep state. Well, what does that mean? It means hiring people who are expert at things. Most people who work, they're quote, deep state, are like engineers people who know how things work. And they're not political. But he wants to get people who are loyal. And then you start getting loyal people. And you start suing broadcast companies for different things. And you start wheedling out people there. And you start and making their stock go down until they have to sell it to someone who's got billions and billions of dollars, who's your part of your oligarchy. And so I think we need to tell people exactly how this happens so people can imagine it.
Yeah, that's what I've been trying to do, and I keep trying to like paint this picture. Like, for instance, I had a very, very high-profile media person who was a very well-known anti-Trumper call me up and say, you know, I'm starting to talk to lawyers about, you know, maybe moving some money out of the country and blah, 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 because he's going to come after me. And I have my kids worried, Dad, he is going to come after me. He is. I've just been, because I knew him, used to know him personally, and I know I get under his skin, and that's where we are. That's where we are. And I want to shake. I get the MAGA people. I get the, your life is miserable and somebody promises you that it's not your fault. It's the immigrant's fault. It's the media's fault. It's the rich banker's fault. It's the Jew's fault. Whoever's fault, it's not your fault. But it's the people with money, the educated people that are voting for Trump that make me sick. The country's been so good to them. They've been sucking on the teat of everything wonderful in this country. Yet they're willing to say, fuck it, because it might be better for me. It doesn't matter what happens to the rest of the fucking world.
Yeah, and I think there are people who genuinely know that he favors the affluent. That's what his tax cut was like when he finally did a tax cut. And people ended up hating that tax cut. But there are people in all walks of life who are for Trump. But you know, something like Fox is so pernicious, and we don't have there's no equivalent. MSNBC is not an equivalent to Fox.
No, it's not.
Because at Fox, they're willing to lie constantly.
But Fox is a bigger problem than Fox. Fox has 3 million viewers a night. There's 330 million people in this country. So it's Fox obviously is a tool. But what I don't understand, in the latest polls, he's tied with young people. That as 18 to 29 year olds, Trump is even ahead by 1 or 2 points. How is that fathomable?
It's really scary, because that you know, the young people skewed Democratic until
obviously,
yeah,
dramatically.
And
so,
and if you think about just the one issue of abortion, they're the ones that have the most interest in that, right?
They're gonna have rights that my mother had that they're not gonna, my daughter's not gonna have.
Yeah, and it's an important right, and it's more important right if you're of an age where, you know, you can impregnate someone or get pregnant. You know,
you and I are aging.
Well, let's put it this way: where you can get pregnant.
yes.
Yeah. And well, let's put it that way. I don't want to say anything about either of us. So it's unfathomable that he would be ahead with young people. It just is. And because that was, And I hope, boy, I don't know how it stays that way. I think Gaza has something to do with that.
Yeah, it definitely has something to do with it. And he's also hemorrhaging in the African American vote, which I still don't get also. I don't know if that's partially the Gaza thing also.
If you think about Gaza, Trump is only going to be worse in terms of support for Netanyahu and in support for...
They're not getting... And I'll take it even one step further. If you're a Jew and I'm Jewish, and I know you are too, Trump, these people would say, I'm voting for Trump because he's good for Israel. Trump would fuck the Jews in a heartbeat if it was in his best interest. Trump has no ideological... And if you're not somebody that is not acutely aware of our history, of what happens with somebody with absolute power who has demonic leanings, gets into power, and that doesn't send shivers up your spine. So these Jews that are blindly following Donald Trump, I also say just shut the fuck up.
Yeah, I don't trust him on anything. I don't think pushing anti-Semitism is going to be the first on his list. But
no.
But I don't trust him on anything. The guy is a malignant narcissist. He is sick. That diagnosis was, as far as I can tell, exactly right on the mark.
Yeah.
He doesn't, and he's in a kind of an extreme version of it too.
He's a sociopath, but you look up sociopath and he hits like 8 of the 9 traits. I mean, he's just pretty
classic.
What's
the one he doesn't?
Not morbidly obese.
That's exactly where I went too.
Yeah.
But I don't think sociopaths are have more weight problem than anybody else.
So you're obviously, beyond being a super successful politician, you're a communicator. You're a performer. You obviously understand messaging. So what would you be telling Democrats to do right now?
I would tell them to go after them and go after Trump and go after whoever Republicans right now as a brand are really awful. They are willing to do anything that Trump says. Mm-hmm. So like giving up on the border bill that was amazing. That was a very strong bill for
Blankford, one of the most conservative senators, his bill,
I spoke with him, and he just couldn't believe that his colleagues were going along with this.
Let me ask you a question: as a man, as a father, as a husband, how do these? This is going to sound like a sexist question, but it's not. How do these men go home and look at their loved ones? How do you look at yourself as a mirror as a man when you are such a toady, submissive, spineless? I understand people want to keep their jobs. I'm not an idiot. I understand what's at stake here. But how do you just live with yourself? I'm talking about the majority of these guys that know the difference.
That's why Lindsey Graham was so easy for him, because he's not married and doesn't have any kids. So he doesn't have to do that. He was the easiest convert. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. But you know these guys. You know a lot of these guys, and personally, and obviously,
yeah. And when he got elected in 2016, talking to them, they couldn't believe it. I think only Sessions had backed him people in the Senate. If I'm correct,
that's right.
I'm
that's
not
why
sure.
That's why he made him Attorney General, which worked out really well
for both of them.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. No, well, he had to recuse himself, as you'll remember, and
yes.
And Trump got pissed at him, and so it wasn't a good marriage.
So, do you miss it?
Oh yeah,
you do
every day. Yeah. Yeah.
So, why don't you run again?
I'm not going to go through that. And I've been living in New York because I have grandchildren here. My grandson is in the living room right now.
Okay.
And homesick from school, but he's home here sick. So. But no, I don't want to do that again. I don't want to run again.
How's it feel doing stand-up again?
It's fun. It's fun. It was funny. I've always combined kind of comedy and politics from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And, even like in grade school or at least comedy with history. The first thing I ever wrote was a sketch a Civil War sketch with Union soldiers in a first aid tent in a like army hospital. And I don't know why I did that, but that was me when I was very young. And so, yeah, this is something I've always done.
Would you say if I was going to ask you your greatest accomplishment as a legislator, would it be the 60th vote on the Affordable Care Act?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, that's it would have
one.
To be.
That's a big one. Yeah. That's what we call a biggie. That's what we call a life well lived.
Yeah, I didn't get in. You know, they had the recount on it before. I could have been seated with the rest of my class. Mm-hmm. But in Minnesota, the Supreme Court the governor has to sign it, and the governor doesn't sign it until the Supreme Court signs off. And Coleman filed a suit. I had won already, but he went to court. And what happened in court, it just Minnesotans take a long time, the judges. And so it took a long time. So I didn't get in there until July. And that's when I was the 60th vote. That's when we knew we had the votes. But even you remember that Scott Brown won and replaced Kennedy?
Massachusetts, yeah.
Yeah, so it had already passed the Senate, but it hadn't passed the House. So we had to, they had to write it in such a way in the House that we could rewrite it enough and, do it with a not, we didn't need 60 votes for it. It was reconciliation. So, but I'm not quite sure why we couldn't have done the whole bill in reconciliation, but, so maybe we didn't need 60. Maybe we need 51. But because they tried to remember when McCain did the thumbs down. Mm-hmm. That was so they couldn't do it. They were trying to do it through reconciliation. So they were trying to do it with 51 votes or 50 votes, I guess.
Speaking of McCain, you would think if Trump, God willing, loses again, that somewhere somebody says, okay, this ain't a winning formula. We gotta, let's maybe put our toe back to where McCain, to where Romney, to Reagan, to W, to these very sane Republicans. But then you go, but the electoral, the primary system is not going to allow for that because it's a 20% fringe that votes.
Right.
So is this a Republican from party, Trump or no Trump from here on in?
I think so. I don't know from here on in, but I think for a while that these MAGA people are the majority of the party and are going to continue to be. So whether, if Trump loses and, we pray he does, then I don't know who who the next one is. I just don't know.
You know, we talk about Trump losing. And I said this in March of 19. I said this on Chris Matthews' show, and it got a lot of attention that if Trump loses, he's not going to leave office and he'll try and create a civil war. And this was 2 years before it happened. If Trump loses this time, it's going to be even worse. He's going to literally tell people to take to the streets. It is so we're in for a hell of a ride one way or the other. But if he loses, there's no reason.
I hope you're wrong, but.
Why wouldn't he if you're him? Why wouldn't you? Now you're going to jail probably, or you're certainly, your future is not going to be headed in the right direction. We know the way he behaves. Why wouldn't he do it at this point?
Well, that's a very big question. And I'm just not sure his people would follow him.
Wow. I hope you're right. I hope you're
right. I just think like when he was indicted, I mean, it increased his polling averages when these indictments, but I don't think people were, they didn't protest that he was indicted. And it depends, of course, how close it is, but
it's going to be close.
It's going to be close.
It's certainly going to be close if the Democrats win. There's a chance it's not close if the Republicans win. I'm really nervous.
I hear that from that. it's going to be close if the Democrats win, but if the Republicans win, it's going to be a blowout. Well, if that's the case, then we're really, really in trouble.
I'm worried. Electoral blowouts, not certainly not from a popular vote point of view, but you look at the map now, and it looks like Arizona and Georgia are going back in the other direction. Nevada mm-hmm. looks like it's in play. And even, here's the scary
Nevada,
thing.
Nevada. Yeah,
here's the scary thing, that even if he takes all three of the blue wall states, if they make this change to that one Nebraska vote, I don't know if the state house has now voted that, it's 269, even with the three Midwestern states, which right now is certainly anything but in the bag. So the map is not looking great for the Democrats right now.
It's 269 with every state that he's ahead in? Is that what you're saying?
If he loses Georgia and Arizona, but the conventional wisdom was if he holds Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, he wins. With that one vote now, he doesn't.
Biden wins.
Biden wins, yeah.
Because he gets 270, but because Nebraska and Maine are the only states, has that been signed? Has that been passed?
No, it's in play.
Okay. If it happens, then it's 269.
Yeah,
which it adds up to 538, right? Mm-hmm. And what happens then? It goes to the House, right?
Which is not a good thing.
Which is bad.
So the Democrats, if they have any fucking brains, they'll quickly pass the law on Maine to push it in the other direction to pick up that one vote. But they don't usually play that way. So,
see, oh, that's right. That's scary right. Scary. Maine could do that.
Yeah, Maine would do that. How are you feeling about things? Are you believing in the better angels and that the optimism? I change every day. Every day I feel differently.
Well, a few minutes ago I was really pessimistic listening to you, but now for some reason I don't know. Oh, I'm back to pessimistic. Shit. I mean, it's scary. It's frightening, and it's gonna be, and it's a long process now.
Yeah.
And so you think every tick of it counts. Every tick of it is important. Every change, you know, every event, every new event that we don't know what each new event is going to be.
Yeah. The thing that gives me some hope is that every time he's out there now, meaning Trump, it's so much darker and worse than it. You know, the first time around, he was a lounge act. You know, and he had a couple of nasty things he would say. But other than that, he was kind of up there entertaining. Now, it's dark.
Really, yes.
And I think that at the end of the day, that darkness might push some people into the light. That's my optimistic side.
I have the same exact thought process.
Yeah.
And I just hope that we're right about the American people.
Yeah.
Because I can't believe that the American people will, you know... What's his latest thing about there'll be a bloodbath?
Yeah.
Really? And now he's changed it from the bloodbath that he talked about the first time. What was the first bloodbath?
Well, he talked about bloodbath. He also talked about the staining of our blood with the immigrants coming in, you know, a great old Nazi trope, you know.
That's Mein Kampf.
Yeah.
All great societies were destroyed when their blood was poisoned.
Yeah, yeah. He hits the greatest hits. He really, really does. It's just, and he tells you. That's the amazing thing. That's what authoritarians do. They tell you what they're going to do. The one thing you got to give this guy is he's transparent. Whether people want to see it or not, he's not hiding in what he wants to do and what he's going to do and how he feels about things.
And the fact that it's working, to the extent that it's working, which is scary, is also very scary. It's just I look at it and I can't believe these are the American people.
I think that it's such a core of people that are afraid that this country is not going to be, it's not going to be majority white in another 6 or 8 years. And they, when you have someone that comes along and says, you know, I'm going to make things the way they were, and you don't have to worry about globalization, you don't have to worry about you know, you losing your job, and you don't have to worry about the Mexican taking your job, and I'm going to keep everybody out and keep it the way it was. And
well, he was going to put 100% tariff on Mexican cars, which
that's
you can't
work.
Do. We signed an agreement.
And the tariff on China is going to double the prices of everything here. I mean, nothing he says makes sense.
You know, the taxes, China doesn't pay The tariff, we do.
Yeah, the consumer pays it. There's no question about that. Yeah. Tell me more about the tour.
Well, let's see. I'm going next to Atlanta. And what I do is I do like in Chicago, I did four shows. And in Nashville, I did two.
Can you do the Schumer impression that you do there? Can we get that right now?
Well, okay. Most of the impression is this. That's like three quarters of the impression. And then the rest is this. He does this with his hands a lot.
He does the hand thing. That's very good. By the way, just visually, it nails it. You don't need much more than that.
That's it. A little bit back here.
Okay, so we do Schumer. What else do we do on the tour?
Oh, I do McConnell. I do Bernie. You don't want me to just go through my...
No, you know, we don't want... People got to pay to see that. You know,
that's right.
We're not giving away the milk here.
Yeah. So, and I talk about, you know, a lot of different things. There's a lot of Trump in it, but there's, it's also, I'm kind of building the plane while I'm flying it. This is sort of the premise of the thing. I'm doing it at the city wineries in all these cities.
Okay.
And so it's about, I don't know, 300, 350 people.
When are you coming to New York?
I'm not scheduled in New York yet.
What the fuck? What is that about?
Well, I want to get the thing together.
Get it right before you bring it to Broadway?
Before I bring it to New York, yeah.
Right. Hey, let's go back a little more serious stuff, Israel. Here's my question that nobody seems to be able to answer. Obviously, everybody wants the war to stop. Yet, and everybody says, well, two-state solution. How do you ever create a two-state solution when 70 or 80% of Gazans support Hamas? At this point, how does that ever work? I mean, in theory, that's what we want, and we want an independent authority. But is it ever realistic? Where's the end to this thing?
Well, you know, Tom Friedman at the beginning of all this said to don't invade. You know, which was in a way unthinkable, considering what happened on October 7th, but. He kind of knew what would happen here. Mm-hmm. And so there is no great solution to this thing. So a two-state solution is the only solution. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how you get – it's unimaginable right now to get from here to there.
Yeah, that's
– And I do think that Netanyahu conducts the war for his own survival.
Yeah, he's got to go. Look, I'm a Zionist, and nobody's been more pro-Israel in the air than me. But Netanyahu, he's got to go. There's no question about that. I mean, that he is doing it for his own survival. I think Benny Gantz would be a great solution. And the problem Israel has now is they're losing the public opinion war. You know, they're just, it is, you see it with young people, you see it, and, you know, they're in a tough position. On the one hand, they've got to completely take out Hamas. You can't let these guys survive. And on the other hand, we see
on the other hand, you're creating Hamas.
You're creating new Hamas at the same time. So they're in a really tough, tough position. It's just,
But I think they've made it worse for themselves in the way they've conducted this war. So
what should they have done differently? What would you have done differently?
Well, I don't know. I'm not smart enough to figure that out. Yeah. But I think I would not be dropping 2,000-pound bombs in areas where you're going to be killing civilians. And Hamas embeds itself with civilians. And so they try to make it as impossible as possible. But they don't care that people are getting killed.
Well, that's the problem. That's the problem. That's the unwinnable Rubik's Cube that you have here. And that's I lay sleep at night. Mr. Senator Al Franken, I so appreciate your time. You are a man of great wisdom, of great courage, great conviction. I wish you were back in the Senate. Doesn't sound like that's happening, but you're going to have to get your voice out there in the city wineries around the country. And that's the next best thing.
Yeah. That'll happen. And thank you. Always great to hear you and to see you.
Great to talk to you. It's Al Franken Podcast. His pack is the Midwest Values Pack. He's touring around the country. Which city?
It's not a super pack. It's not a super pack.
It's just a pack. It's just a pack. What cities are you going to be in? Just let's get some dates and places out there for people.
I don't have my dates. Atlanta, in a few weeks, and then up to Philadelphia, I think, and then over to Pittsburgh, then down, no, then up to Boston.
So it's an Amtrak. It's an Amtrak deal.
What I do is I do fly.
Okay. But
not to Philadelphia. That'll be that'll be a car. But no, I got my transportation worked out.
Okay, thanks. Good to the viewers. Al Franken, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure. I've always been a big fan, and I continue to be so.
Likewise. Thank you, sir.